Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Phyllis Bennis with the Institute for Policy Studies, who assesses the legacy of Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and the shape of Middle East politics after the former general suffered an incapacitating stroke. Moira Feeney, an attorney with the Center for Justice and Accountability, who summarizes her group's successful lawsuit seeking damages for torture and other human rights violations against Salvadoran generals living in the United States. And Chris Kutalik, editor of Labor Notes, who takes a hard look at mine safety issues and federal regulations after the deaths of 12 coal miners at West Virginia's Sago Mine. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On New Year's Day, Paris-based Reporters Without Borders counted 126 journalists and 70 cyber dissidents in prison across the globe. 2005 finished as the bloodiest year for journalists in a decade. 63 journalists and 5 media assistants were killed. 807 working reporters were arrested, and over 1,300 journalists were attacked or threatened. The advocacy group also identified 1,000 media outlets that were censored. In Iraq, 24 journalists and 5 media assistants were killed last year. Since the U.S.-led invasion in March 2003, 76 reporters and media workers have been killed during the war and occupation, more than the 20-year total during the Vietnam War. Most were killed in terror attacks or by insurgents. However, 3 were killed by the U.S. Army, including Iraqi TV producer Wael al-Bakri, whose death in late June is being investigated by the U.S. 3rd Infantry. The Philippines was the second deadliest place to be a journalist. 7 reporters were killed there during 2005. The media report counts nearly an attack every day against journalists in the nations of Bangladesh and Nepal. Advocates of a free press worry that much of the violence against independent journalists goes unpunished. As Ann Cooper of the New York-based Committee to Protect Journalists stated, 3 out of 4 journalists killed around the world are singled out for murder, and their killers are rarely brought to justice. On January 24th, the U.S. government will decide whether to set free exiled Cuban militant Luis Posada Carriles from an El Paso immigration facility. In Venezuela, where Posada is a convicted terrorist, the government wants to extradite Posada for his role in the 1976 bombing of a Cuban passenger plane that killed all 73 people on board. If released, Posada will be allowed to stay in the United States under supervision. According to the Miami Herald, last month, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement sent Posada a letter asking him to submit evidence to support his release. His custody status will then be reviewed, and release will depend on Posada's ability to illustrate to the Attorney General and Secretary of Homeland Security that he will not pose a danger to the community nor a flight risk. Eduardo Soto, Posada's attorney, says that in order to keep Posada locked up, authorities need to prove he is a danger to society. However, Jose Pertiera, a Cuban-American lawyer in Washington representing the Venezuelan government, fears the U.S. may very well release Posada. Posada is also accused of masterminding a series of hotel bombings in Cuba from 1996 through 1998 that resulted in the killing of an Italian tourist. On March 21st, the first day of spring in 2005, a landslide in the town of Mailusu in Kyrgyzstan left 13 families homeless and killed 2 girls. Rain brought more mudslides. Debris came dangerously close to Soviet-era uranium tailings and destroyed protective dams encircling the area's radioactive dumps. According to the New Internationalist magazine, Mailusu sits on the northern edge of the Fergana Valley, the most populated region in Central Asia. From 1946 to 1973, uranium mines near Mailusu provided the fuel for the Soviet-era nuclear arsenal. Nuclear waste was left behind or stored in toxic piles and never safely sealed. Because of continued neglect, the residents of the region breathe air with high levels of radon particles. Experts also say the uranium dumps are in dire need of repair and at continuing risk from mudslides and earthquakes. Despite the dangers, many residents ignore the hazard signs and graze their cattle near radioactive tailings. Others dig in the uranium dumps for scrap metal to sell, and health data shows a rising cancer rate among the population. As research scientist Yuri Alashin noted, it's frightening to see the children play amid lead and zinc dust, raising particles up into the air and breathing it. All of this might turn out to be a personal tragedy for them in the future. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Denise Manzari. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
After suffering a massive stroke on January 4th, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon lies in critical condition at a Jerusalem hospital. According to doctors, the 77-year-old former general, the extent of his brain damage not yet known, is unlikely to resume his duties in government. While much of the U.S. media has described Sharon as a man of peace, praising his unilateral withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, many observers disagree. Sharon, who led the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon, is held responsible by many in the Arab world for the massacre of hundreds of Palestinians in the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Beirut. Many critics also believe Sharon's construction of a separation wall and expansion of West Bank settlements have been an obstacle to peace. Before his stroke, polls predicted that Israeli voters would have re-elected Sharon in a March 28th parliamentary ballot. Acting Prime Minister Ehud Olmert is likely to take Sharon's place leading the new Kadima party in the coming election. Palestinians are scheduled to hold their own parliamentary election on January 25th. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, who examines Ariel Sharon's legacy and the shape of Middle East politics after his departure from the political scene.
I think Sharon is going to have two legacies. One will be the legacy of the United States. He will be lauded in history, at least for a while, as being the closest ally of the United States in the Middle East, as being George Bush's, quote, man of peace, despite his military history, despite his role in the Sabra Shatila massacres, in which an Israeli investigating commission found him to be indirectly responsible. We will hear that his unilateral disengagement from Gaza was the bravest, most courageous, and most important move in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in recent history. Then there will be the legacy that he has in the rest of the world, not only in the Palestinian territories, in the Arab world, or in the global south, but I think in the entire world. He will be viewed primarily through the legacy of being a war criminal for his acts, particularly in the Lebanon War in 1982, when under his authority, the militias, the right-wing Christian militias of Lebanon, massacred Palestinians, leaving over 20,000 Palestinians dead in the Sabra and Shatila camps, and for his role in as the godfather, if you will, of the Israeli settlement project. The settlements didn't begin under Sharon's period in government. He was still a general. He was still in his military service when they began. They began under, of course, the Labor Party. But it was when Sharon came to power as taking over a ministry in the 1970s that the settlement project really took on new life and became the primary focus of Israeli political activity. I think that's the legacy that will follow him.
Phyllis, upon the death of Yasser Arafat, there were many predictions that he, Arafat, was the obstacle to Israeli-Palestinian peace, and that upon his death, a new leadership within the Palestinian Authority, things would go in a positive direction. Give us a real quick summary of the status of Israeli-Palestinian negotiations at the moment Sharon was struck down by this massive stroke.
Well, it's easy to do that really quickly, Scott. There are none. There have been no negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. The only negotiations that the Israelis have engaged in have been with the United States. The legacy Sharon leaves behind is the legacy of unilateralism. He maintained, I have no partner for peace, and therefore I can do what I want, I can set borders where I want, I can make the route of the so-called separation wall, what many call the apartheid wall, I can make that route an international border, and President Bush will support that, and indeed there's no indication that he would not. Certainly the withdrawal of settlers and soldiers from Gaza was a unilateral obligation of Israel, as is the unilateral withdrawal of soldiers and settlers from the West Bank. That's a unilateral obligation. But that obligation, of course, was not met. what the real obligation includes is actual ending of the occupation, not simply withdrawing soldiers to the edges of the border and essentially putting Gaza under a state of siege.
Phyllis, both Israeli citizens and Palestinians will be electing new leadership soon. What are some of your concerns and predictions about where Israel may go after Sharon, as he has left the political scene due to his illness?
Well, I'm afraid that what we're going to face, Scott, is an absolute stall in any diplomatic motion. The question of who will lead Israel remains somewhat uncertain. The post-stroke polls have indicated that Sharon's new party, the Kadima Party, would still win a plurality in the new Knesset in the March elections. But that certainly may well change. The old Likud party, now led by Bibi Netanyahu, which has staked out a position far to the right of Sharon's Kadima, will be part of that coalition. It's possible there could even be a grand coalition with Labor as well. But whatever mix of political parties takes power, there's going to be a great deal of jockeying for control, jockeying for public support. That means, among other things, an effort by the leaders of all the parties to put themselves forward to the voters as being as strong as Sharon on security. Security was the linchpin of Sharon's appeal to the Israeli public. And because none of the other leaders have anything close to his history as a military leader, the kind of forceful bulldozer reputation that he had, they are all going to be jumping through hoops trying to prove themselves to be the strongest, the toughest, etc. That bodes very badly for the Palestinians. In the meantime, the deteriorating conditions that Palestinians face today, with the expansion of settlements, the growth of the wall, the escalation of targeted assassinations, the proliferation of checkpoints across the occupied territories, unemployment, which the World Bank just announced that unemployment for men between 16 and 25 in the refugee camps, in the Palestinian camps, the most volatile sector of the population, unemployment for that sector is 75%. This is a disaster, and there's absolutely no indication that any emerging Israeli leader or coalition is prepared to do anything to change it. The new Palestinian leadership that will come in has simply no power to change it.
That was Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Her latest book is titled Challenging Empire: How People, Governments, and the UN Defy U.S. Power. Contact the Institute by calling area code 202-234-9382 or visit their website at www.ips-dc.org. On January 6th, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, based in Atlanta, reversed its earlier ruling on a seminal human rights case. The court had originally sided with the defendants, Generals Jose Guillermo Garcia and Carlos Eugenio Vides Casanova, who had both served as defense minister in El Salvador during the 1980s. The men served in governments which tortured its citizens with impunity during the Civil War, in which 70,000 Salvadorans died, mostly at the hands of the military and its allied death squads. After three torture survivors won an initial court victory, suing the men for their grave human rights abuses, the U.S. Appeals Court ruled last February that the statute of limitations had expired for bringing suit against the generals, who moved to the U.S. in 1989. But in its new decision, the court ruled that the clock on the 10-year statute of limitations didn't begin ticking until 1992, after a peace agreement ended the war in El Salvador. So the ruling reinstated the finding for the plaintiffs, Neris Gonzalez, Juan Ramagosa, and Carlos Mauricio, who are now eligible to collect damages. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Moira Feeney, a lawyer with the Center for Justice and Accountability in San Francisco, the group which brought the lawsuit. She explains the mission of the center, founded in 1998, and summarizes the case against the Salvadoran generals.
We represent survivors of torture and individuals who have lost family members to extrajudicial killing in countries around the world, to bring claims when it becomes known to them and becomes known to their community that perpetrators are now living in the U.S. and under U.S. jurisdiction. They filed the case in 1999, and in 2002, it finally went to trial, and there was a four-week-long trial in West Palm Beach in Florida All three of the plaintiffs took the stand and told their stories of survival. The defendants were there in person and brought witnesses to try to defend their case, and the jury awarded a $54.6 million verdict in favor of the plaintiffs, and that is for punitive and compensatory damages. Now, immediately, the defendants appealed that decision, and they appealed based on this legal technicality, which is known as the statute of limitations. And it was their argument that too much time had passed since the date of the atrocities in the early 80s and when the clients, these plaintiffs, actually filed their case in 1999. And in early 2005, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals issued a decision that agreed with the defendants and said that too much time had passed and that the statute of limitations had been exceeded. But then a couple of months later, they actually sent a letter to us, to the counsel for the plaintiffs, and said that they recognized there were some factual errors in their decision and asked for letter briefing about various different issues. And after that was completed, they issued an order that actually vacated their own decision. And now that order was issued in August of 2005, and we've been waiting for a decision. And finally, this week, we got that decision, and all of the three plaintiffs' claims have been reinstated, and the jury verdict of $54.6 million stands.
Are the plaintiffs likely to receive any money?
You know, the clients and the plaintiffs in these cases, and in this case in particular, are very adamant that people understand that the motivation for bringing these cases is not about money, that they were very interested in having their day in court and their opportunity to take the stand and to give their story of survival and to really create the historical record of the atrocities that they suffered but that their fellow Salvadorans suffered during this time period. Now that we have this final decision that does affirm that jury verdict, the defendants have an opportunity to appeal to the Supreme Court if they would like, and they have 90 days to do so. But if they do not do so, then this decision is final, and we do have the right to move to collect assets from these defendants. Now, we don't have any reason to think that these defendants have $54.6 million, but if they do have assets, then they are in debt to our clients, and they need to make payments.
When the defendants appealed the original verdict, they did it on the basis that the statute of limitations had expired. Did they appeal it at all on the basis that they weren't culpable?
The only issue on the appeal was the statute of limitations.
So this reversal by the appeals court is really good news, but this isn't groundbreaking in the sense that since you filed this first case, you've already had two other jury verdicts in your favor, right?
Right, although it's important to point out that this case has come sort of full circle. So that is, we had a jury verdict in Memphis, but surely the defense will appeal, and it will continue to be fought out at the appeals level. And we're optimistic that we'll win, especially now because of this decision. Even though it's in another circuit, it's extremely persuasive and important legal precedents now. And I should point out that it's not that this decision, this most recent decision, is one of three decisions just this year issued by the 11th Circuit in our cases that CJA has brought on behalf of torture survivors, in which the statute of limitation issue was brought up. And we've had favorable outcomes in all three of those cases. And one had to do with Chile, one had to do with Haiti, and now this one is El Salvador.
Moira Feeney, are there people waiting in the wings now to file other cases under the Alien Tort Claims Act and the Torture Victim Protection Act?
We represent clients from Somalia, from Haiti, from Chile, from many countries around the world, and we continue to bring cases. And we are thrilled that the 11th Circuit, not at all considered a progressive or liberal court of law, has supported and reaffirmed these two important federal statutes under which that we bring these cases, and will continue to do so.
That was Moira Feeney, an attorney with the Center for Justice and Accountability. For information on this and other human rights lawsuits the group is pursuing, call the center at area code 415-544-0444. Or visit their website at www.cja.org. An underground explosion at West Virginia's Sago coal mine on January 2nd trapped 13 miners and led to the deaths of 12 of those men. Although media attention on the mining accident initially focused on the tragic miscommunication that led family members to believe that all the miners had been saved when only one was actually found alive, more important issues of mine safety have been glossed over. Over the past 2 years, the non-union Sago mine was cited 273 times for safety violations by the Labor Department's Mine Safety and Health Administration, or MSHA. 16 violations occurring in the past 8 months at Sago were classified as serious safety infractions for which the operator had already received warnings. 18 of the 46 most recent violations were issued for inadequate measures to prevent the mine's roof collapsing and insufficient ventilation to avert the buildup of dangerous gases. A Knight Ridder investigation concluded that since taking office in 2001, the Bush administration has issued fewer and smaller major fines on the coal industry and collected less than half of the money that violators owed. Under Mr. Bush, the number of mining inspectors has been reduced by 100. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Chris Kutalik, editor of the magazine Labor Notes, who takes a hard look at mine safety issues surrounding the 12 deaths at the Sago mine.
In many ways, this whole tragedy was called an accident, and I think that's really gets at the heart of the issue in the fact that I don't think that it was an accident in many ways, in the sense that there was a persistent pattern of workplace violations, of lack of inspection, and I think this covers over into many areas that are broader problems with workplace safety hazards in this country. For instance, this mine itself, which came back into operation in 2004, had 273 violations in a two-year period, 208 of those in 2005 alone. Its injury rate, compared to the average mine, average coal mine, which is in itself a really a place that workers are hurt more often than in other places, quite dangerous work, was three times as much as an average mine. So you had this sort of persistent pattern of abuses. And these weren't just little infractions, too. These were major, major infractions. For instance, there were seven times they failed to do a pre-shift examination. This is when you go down in a coal mine and simply walk the length of the mine and make sure that things are okay, right? The coal miners union, the United Mine Workers Union, say this is one of the most important safety things you can do in a mine is do this pre-shift examination. They failed this seven times. They had 18 what they call warrantable offenses, and this means offenses that they saw that there were major problems happening in the mine, and they didn't fix them. One would assume that this would actually have brought some attention to the authorities, right, that MSHA, which is the Mine Safety and Health Administration, which is some of your listeners might be familiar with OSHA, which is deals with occupational safe and healthy, which is the federal agency that overlooks mine safety, would have done something about it. But what you had, instead of some very strict coming down on this company very hard and things getting fixed, they only fined them $24,000, 208 violations, not a single violation. They fined more than $440. And I think there's some reasons for this, most of them being that MSHA is virtually staffed at the top by former coal industry executives.
Chris, we all remember quite clearly during the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina that the head of the Federal Emergency Management Administration, Michael Brown, you're doing a heck of a job, Brownie, was really revealed to be a hack, a crony, who was not qualified to be the administrator of FEMA. What do we know about the head of the Mine Safety and Health Administration under George Bush? Who's minding the store there, and are they qualified?
Richard Stickler, who is head of MSHA currently, is a former coal industry executive. He worked for Betts Energy, which is a coal mining company, and he worked for them for something like 30 years. And in a way, it's actually worse than Katrina, because instead of, you know, you having someone who's just merely incompetent, you also have someone who has a vested interest in keeping wages down, keeping unions out of the mines, and keeping mines running at a fast pace, extracting coal. Price of coal has been rising rapidly in the last 2 years without the burden of what they consider undue costs due to health and safety inspections and equipment and regulation.
What kinds of reforms do you think could be effective in righting some of the wrongs or trying to regain some of the safety regulations that have been dumped by the Bush administration here in the aftermath of the Sago mining disaster?
Much of it has to do with the workers themselves. They're going to have to get organized, whether that's in a union or any other kind of collective action. They're the ones in the mines. They're the ones who are going to need to push at that level for consistent enforcement. Now, it also entails continued focus on this, because I think that there is a tremendous amount of pressure. I think there's a great amount of concern and some fine journalism in smaller regional papers really sort of pulling away at what's happening at this thing. But I'm not convinced that the internal inspection that's going on by MSHA is going to mean much of anything. It would be akin to saying, well, we'll let FEMA take care of what happened after Katrina. It took this tremendous sort of outcry and tremendous pressure at the horrific things that had happened under Katrina in order to push them to do anything. So I think that there needs to be a similar movement of concerned citizens, unions, moving around this, pushing for reforms, not just in the mines, but in all workplaces. In 2002 alone, for instance, you had something like 4,500 workplace fatalities. That's 15 deaths per day in American workplaces, which is a phenomenal rate if you think about it. And that really is not acceptable.
That was Chris Kutalik, editor of Labor Notes. Contact Labor Notes Detroit office by calling area code 313-842-6262. Or visit the magazine's website at www.labornotes.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Phil Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Vanzari.